simple and very sad story. Lincoln's son, Willie, who was supposedly his favorite, the most like Lincoln himself, got typhoid, and along with his brother, Tad. And they thought it was under control. The Lincolns got permission from the doctor to throw this kind of reception they were playing at the White House. And that night, Willie got worse. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, he passed away, just completely, you know, traumatizing the family and especially Lincoln. And then there was just a mention in the newspapers at the time that Lincoln had gone into the crypt. They had borrowed a friend's crypt to inter their son while they were in Washington. The report said he had somehow interacted with the body, had looked at it or had held it or had stroked the hair or something like that. So that's really the whole story of the book. It's just that night, the night that Lincoln goes into the crypt. So it sounds like a real uplifting, you know, laugh riot. But
but Lincoln and his son Willie are not the only characters in the book. As it turns out, the cemetery is full of people who are. I introduced it as being trapped in limbo, but you used the more exotic term bardo. Can you describe those people who live in the cemetery and the condition they're in?
Yeah, I mean, one of the challenges of this book is since it's just Lincoln going into a crypt and coming out again, it's, you know, you need some additional narration. And I thought, well, that's, you know, who else is in a grave the other night? You get these sort of trapped spirits. I was raised Catholic, and my, you know, my sort of visceral understanding of limbo or purgatory is a little bit, you know, it's sort of all over for you if you're in that state. You lived in a way that wasn't the best, and now you're made to sit on a hard bench for all of eternity until, you know, until the end of days. Bardo is a Tibetan term that means transitional state. There are many bardos. We're in one right now, actually. We're in the bardo between a birth and death. The one that I'm referring to in the book is the one that starts at the moment of your death and goes to, you know, whatever comes next in reincarnation or heaven or hell. So that's one bardo. I thought that was an interesting choice, almost as if for a writer I had to remind myself not to make it too purgatorial. Like the bardo is actually a little bit transactional. You can kind of, it responds very directly to the kind of person you were in life. And at least, I think, at least in my book, there's some notion that if you understood it correctly, you could then escape and go on to your destiny. So I kind of use that word just to remind myself not to make that afterlife too pat, you know, or too predictable or too much like an afterlife we've seen.
Spiritualism, the idea that the dead are still among us and can communicate with us, was really at its heyday in the 19th century. How did that figure into your story?
Well, I think it made me understand that initial visit that Lincoln made to the crypt a little differently. You know, when I first heard it, it sounded a little bit strange and macabre and a little gothic, you know, and then when you start to look at at that time, you see that they were much more comfortable with the dead body. They were, you know, they would have wakes in the house and so on. And also at that time, there's so much death, you know, so much young death. So it helped me a little bit to understand that the 19th century idea of death was quite different from ours. You know, we tend to rush the body away and treat it as something that you don't want to look at or think about. But I think they had a more organic approach to it. And, of course, Lincoln himself and his wife, they were involved in some spiritualism after Willie's death because the loss was so extreme and so harsh that I think they never got over it. They were talking about it on the last day of Lincoln's life, talking about how they might finally, you know, conspire to get over this and get back to being the couple they had been before his death.
When your subject is as fantastical as this is, what kind of research do you do?
Well, that's a good question, because actually what I found with this book was the stranger it got, the more grounded it had to be in facts. So I did a lot of reading about Lincoln, and especially about that particular period in his life, the illness and death of Willie, and then the period just after. My feeling is, you know, a lot of fiction is kind of a game. It's sort of a seduction between reader and writer. You know that I'm making this story up, and especially with this one, you know that there's a lot of crazy stuff going on. So then we're in a bit of a dance. I'm going to say some things that strain credulity a bit. You're going to back away. I'm going to somehow pull you back in again. And the idea is to get you to the end of the book deeply believing in that fictive reality. And in this book, I found that the historical research and the facts of the case were a good way to sort of get the reader back a little bit. It's sort of a almost like riding a bike. You know, sometimes you get a little to the left, meaning the book is getting to be too much to believe. But then you say to yourself, okay, to correct this, I have to lean to the right. Let me talk about the Civil War in strictly factual terms. And so that's kind of the dance that you do as a writer. Fiction itself is such a weird proposition. When you pick up a novel, you know it's not true. You know that the writer has manipulated reality to make this fictive dream that you're consenting to go into. So that's an interesting thing. I think what we do is we say to the writer, I'm going to allow you to basically lie to me in the service of a higher truth. In this case, I kind of knew it was a rough entry. I was asking a lot of the reader in the first 20 or 30 pages. And I tried to make it as easy as possible, but I also had an idea that if I could get certain things started there, they would really pay off in the last third of the book. And so that's kind of the contract. You know, I like the idea that a book should be challenging, but not gratuitously so. In other words, I'm going to try to, in my revising, to make it a pleasurable and easy experience for you, but it still might take a little bit of acclimation time. And that's okay. I think, you know, generally readers and writers agree to that as long as there's a payoff in the end.
One of the more delightful parts of the book, or at least I thought so, was the character's utter obliviousness to the fact that they're dead. They call their coffins sick boxes. Usually after an awkward pause, they refer to their corporal bodies as their sick forms. How can they be so clueless?
Well, I kind of look at us, you know. How many times a day does somebody say, "Hi, I'm a walking corpse"? You know, in 50 years, I shall be no more. I mean, you know, we know that at some level, but it's considered somewhat impolite to dwell on it. You know, it's considered morbid, I think, to let death dominate your life. Or the other thing I think I do all the time, is a kind of a, an energetic construction of an identity that is maybe, it's hopeful. You know, I like to think of myself as a good writer, a good father, a good husband, a good citizen, a mindful person, all these things. But of course, every day you have to reconstruct that identity. It's not, you actually do things all the time that subtle and not so subtle ways violate your self-identity. So I think they're doing in death an exaggerated version of what we basically do in life. I think in this book, you know, one of the things that moved me, so I didn't know this was going to happen, but how much the dead envy the living. They are so nostalgic for the time when they were living. They can sense that they used to be more vital. There was something more active and wonderful about them, but they don't quite know what changed. And so they're very energized when Lincoln comes into the graveyard and actually pays attention to one of their number, his son. So I had read in some books about ghosts that the dead really like to be remembered. And they like, for example, photographs of themselves to be out. They like to be respected by the living.
And yet, the way the people in the Bardo describe us, the living, who come to visit the cemetery with their cigars, their wreaths, their tears, their crepe, their rumors, their hissing of things that having nothing to do with us, we're so self-absorbed, and yet so are they.
Yeah, that's right. I think they like us if we're properly obsequious. But I felt there that they were a little bit like these kids that have to work in the state park concession areas. You know, they're sitting there at Yosemite and they get the same question 400 times a day, and people are tramping through the store. So yeah, I think they don't like that. They don't like when people come to the graveyard and treat them as if they're dead. You know, when they come to the graveyard and indulge in their own grief and don't take a real moment to think about the people there, you know.
George, I understand that actors Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally have purchased the film rights to Lincoln and the Bardo. Given the fantastical nature of the subject matter, are you nervous at all about seeing this on the screen?
Yes. And that's the best thing, is to be a little nervous. Because I was nervous the whole time I wrote this. So I'm always nervous. But, I mean, when you have weird material, the first order worry is that you won't be able to pull it off. The second one is that it'll be cheesy or that the reader won't believe it. You know, so all those things are definitely at play. And I think I'm going to write the screenplay, so that makes me even more nervous. But I think the idea is, if you, in my experience, if you know what you're going to do in a work of art, you're in trouble, because the danger is you might just do that thing, which somehow ends up to be a bore for everybody. You know, if you, in other words, art is not, in my experience, a process of me knowing what I want to do, and then me doing it, and then dumping it on you, and going, see, wasn't that great? It's much more troubling than that. You know, you start out, the book throws you a curve, this doesn't work, that doesn't work, you're nervous, you're failing. It's that, I think the work of art that's vital, it comes from doubt. It comes from problems. It comes from recognizing on page 40 that you've got a huge problem that you didn't anticipate. Then the book kind of grows around that problem and incorporates it and so on. So one of the things I've been saying to the people that, you know, that are involved in the early stages of this movie is, let's remember that it's not going to be the book, and that it's got to be as weird as the book. And we have to go through as strange a process in making the movie as I went through in writing the book. So, and which means sort of saying it might be impossible, you know, and it might be bad.
George, do you have a copy of the book with you? If you don't mind, I'd love to have you read an excerpt.
I do, yeah. Let me just see. Yeah, so this is just a section where the dead kind of reflect on what it feels like to be in that state of being dead and a little bit forgotten, and their vague sense that they're being underestimated by the living. Please do not misunderstand. We had been mothers, fathers, had been husbands in many years, men of import who had come here that first day, accompanied by crowds so vast and sorrowful that, surging forward to hear the oration, they had damaged fences beyond repair. Had been young wives, diverted here during childbirth, our gentle qualities stripped from us by the naked pain of that circumstance, who left behind husbands so enamored of us, so tormented by the horrors of those last moments, the notion that we had gone down that awful black hole, pain sundered from ourselves, that they had never loved again. Had been bulky men, quietly content, who in our first youth had come to grasp our own unremarkableness and had cheerfully, as if amusedly accepting a heavy burden, shifted our life's focus. If we would not be great, we would be useful, would be rich and kind, and thereby able to effect good, smiling, hands in pockets, watching the world we had subtly improved, walking past this empty dowry filled, that education secretly funded. Had been affable, joking servants, of whom our masters had grown fond for the cheering words we managed that they launched forth on days full of import. Had been grandmothers, tolerant and frank, recipients of certain dark secrets, who, by the quality of their unjudging listening, granted tacit forgiveness and thus let in the sun. What I mean to say is, we had been considerable, had been loved, not lonely, not lost, not freakish, but wise, each in his or her own way. Our departures caused pain. Those who had loved us sat upon their beds, heads in hand, lowered their faces to tabletops, making animal noises. We had been loved, I say, and remembering us, even many years later, people would smile, briefly gladdened at the memory.
That's George Saunders reading from his novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. George Saunders is the author of one of the most original novels on the best-selling list. Lincoln in the Bardo tells the story of Willie Lincoln, the president's son, who's just passed away and is trapped in limbo. George Saunders will speak at Lawrence's Liberty Hall on Tuesday, October 10th, sponsored by the Lawrence Public Library. He joins us today by telephone from New York City. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Great to be here.
For our listeners who haven't yet read Lincoln in the Bardo, take us back to 1862. Can you give us a brief synopsis?
Yeah, basically it's just a very simple and very sad story. Lincoln's son, Willie, who was supposedly his favorite, the most like Lincoln himself, got typhoid, and along with his brother, Tad. And they thought it was under control. The Lincolns got permission from the doctor to throw this kind of reception they were playing at the White House. And that night, Willie got worse. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, he passed away, just completely, you know, traumatizing the family and especially Lincoln. And then there was just a mention in the newspapers at the time that Lincoln had gone into the crypt. They had borrowed a friend's crypt to inter their son while they're in Washington. The report said he had somehow interacted with the body, had looked at it or had held it or had stroked the hair or something like that. So that's really the whole story of the book. It's just that night, the night that Lincoln goes into the crypt. So it sounds like a real uplifting, laugh riot. But
but Lincoln and his son, Willie, are not the only characters in the book. As it turns out, the cemetery is full of people who are, I introduced it as being trapped in limbo, but you use the more exotic term bardo. Can you describe those people who live in the cemetery and the condition they're in?
Yeah, I mean, one of the challenges of this book is since it's just Lincoln going into a crypt and coming out again, you need some additional narration. And I thought, well, that's, who else is in a grave the other night? You get these sort of trapped spirits. I was raised Catholic, and my sort of visceral understanding of limbo or purgatory is a little bit, it's sort of all over for you if you're in that state. You lived in a way that wasn't the best, and now you're made to sit on a hard bench for all of eternity until the end of days. Bardo is a Tibetan term that means transitional state. There are many bardos. We're in one right now, actually. We're in the bardo between a birth and death. The one that I'm referring to in the book is the one that starts at the moment of your death and goes to, whatever comes next in reincarnation or heaven or hell. So that's one bardo. I thought that was an interesting choice, almost as if for a writer, I had to remind myself not to make it too purgatorial. Like, the bardo is actually a little bit transactional. You can kind of, it responds very directly to the kind of person you were in life. And at least in my book, there's some notion that if you understood it correctly, you could then escape and go on to your destiny. So I kind of use that word just to remind myself not to make that afterlife too pat, or too predictable or too much like an afterlife we've seen.
Spiritualism, the idea that the dead are still among us and can communicate with us, was really at its heyday in the 19th century. How did that figure into your story?
Well, I think it made me understand that initial visit that Lincoln made to the crypt a little differently. When I first heard it, it sounded a little bit strange and macabre and a little gothic, and then when you start to look at that time, you see that they were much more comfortable with the dead body. They were, that they would have wakes in the house and so on. And also at that time, there's so much death, so much young death. So it helped me a little bit to understand that the 19th century idea of death was quite different from ours. We tend to brush the body away and treat it as something that you don't want to look at or think about. But I think they had a more organic approach to it. And of course, Lincoln himself and his wife, they were involved in some spiritualism after Willie's death, because the loss was so extreme and so harsh that they never got over it. They were talking about it on the last day of Lincoln's life, talking about how they might finally, conspire to get over this and get back to being the couple they had been before his death.
When your subject is as fantastical as this is, what kind of research do you do?
Well, that's a good question, because actually what I found with this book was the stranger it got, the more grounded it had to be in facts. So I did a lot of reading about Lincoln, and especially about that particular period in his life, the illness and death of Willie, and then the period just after. My feeling is, a lot of fiction is kind of a game. It's sort of a seduction between reader and writer. You know that I'm making this story up, and especially with this one, that this is, there's a lot of crazy stuff going on. So then we're in a bit of a dance. I'm going to say some things that strain credulity a bit. You're going to back away. I'm going to somehow pull you back in again. And the idea is to get you to the end of the book deeply believing in that fictive reality. And in this book, I found that the historical research and the facts of the case were a good way to sort of get the reader back a little bit. It's sort of a almost like riding a bike. Sometimes you get a little to the left, meaning the book is getting to be too much to believe. But then you say to yourself, okay, to correct this, I have to lean to the right. Let me talk about the Civil War in strictly factual terms. And so that's kind of the dance that you do as a writer. Fiction itself is such a weird proposition. When you pick up a novel, you know it's not true. You know that the writer has manipulated reality to make this fictive dream that you're consenting to go into. So that's an interesting thing. I think what we do is we say to the writer, I'm going to allow you to basically lie to me in the service of a higher truth. In this case, I kind of knew it was a rough entry. I was asking a lot of the reader in the first 20 or 30 pages, and I tried to make it as easy as possible, but I also had an idea that if I could get certain things started there, they would really pay off in the last third of the book. And so that's kind of the contract. You know, I like the idea that a book should be challenging, but not gratuitously so. In other words, I'm going to try to, in my revising, to make it a pleasurable and easy experience for you, but it still might take a little bit of acclimation time. And that's okay. I think, you know, generally readers and writers agree to that as long as there's a payoff in the end.
One of the more delightful parts of the book, or at least I thought so, was the character's utter obliviousness to the fact that they're dead. They call their coffins sick boxes. Usually after an awkward pause, they refer to their corporal bodies as their sick forms. How can they be so clueless?
Well, I kind of look at us, you know. How many times a day does somebody say, "Hi, I'm a walking corpse"? You know, in 50 years, I shall be no more. I mean, you know, we know that at some level, but it's considered somewhat impolite to dwell on it. You know, it's considered morbid, I think, to, you know, to let death dominate your life. Or the other thing I think I do all the is a kind of a, you know, an energetic construction of an identity that is maybe, it's hopeful. You know, I like to think of myself as a good writer, a good father, a good husband, a good citizen, a mindful person, all these things. But of course, every day you have to reconstruct that identity. It's not, you actually do things all the time that subtle and not so subtle ways violate your self-identity. So I think they're doing in death an exaggerated version of what we basically do in life. I think in this book, you know, one of the things that moved me, so I didn't know this was going to happen, but how much the dead envy the living. They are so nostalgic for the time when they were living. They can sense that they used to be more vital. There was something more active and wonderful about them, but they don't quite know what changed. And so they're very energized when Lincoln comes into the graveyard and actually pays attention to one of their number, his son. So I had read in some books about ghosts that the dead really like to be remembered. And they like, for example, photographs of themselves to be out. They like to be respected by the living.
And yet, the way the people in the Bardo describe us, the living, who come to visit the cemetery with their cigars, their wreaths, their tears, their crepe, their rumors, their hissing of things that having nothing to do with us, we're so self-absorbed, and yet so are they.
Yeah, that's right. I think they like us if we're properly obsequious. But I felt there that they were a little bit like these kids that have to work in the state park concession areas. You know, they're sitting there at Yosemite and they get the same question 400 times a day, and people are tramping through the store. So yeah, I think they don't like that. They don't like when people come to the graveyard and treat them as if they're dead. You know, when they come to the graveyard and indulge in their own grief and don't take a real moment to think about the people there, you know.
George, I understand that actors Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally have purchased the film rights to Lincoln and the Bardo. Given the fantastical nature of the subject matter, are you nervous at all about seeing this on the screen?
Yes. And that's the best thing, is to be a little nervous. Because I was nervous the whole time I wrote this. So I'm always nervous. But, I mean, when you have weird material, the first order worry is that you won't be able to pull it off. The second one is that it'll be cheesy or that the reader won't believe it. You know, so all those things are definitely at play. And I think I'm going to write the screenplay, so that makes me even more nervous. But I think the idea is if you know what you're going to do in a work of art, you're in trouble. Because the danger is you might just do that thing, which somehow ends up to be a bore for everybody. You know, in other words, art is not, in my experience, a process of me knowing what I want to do, and then me doing it, and then dumping it on you, and going, see, wasn't that great? It's much more troubling than that. You know, you start out, the book throws you a curve, this doesn't work, that doesn't work, you're nervous, you're you're failing. It's that, I think, the work of art that's vital, it comes from doubt. It comes from problems. It comes from recognizing on page 40 that you've got a huge problem that you didn't anticipate. Then the book kind of grows around that problem and incorporates it and so on. So one of the things I've been saying to the people that, you know, that are involved in the early stages of this movie is, let's remember that it's not going to be the book, and that it's got to be as weird as the book, and we have to go through as strange a process in making the movie as I went through in writing the book. So, and which means sort of saying it might be impossible, and it might be bad.
George, much of your writing has been in the form of short stories and essays. How did this story better lend itself to a longer form novel?
You know, my wife kids me because there's so much white space in this book that it's kind of a novella-length thing, actually. I had given up on the idea of writing a novel. I didn't have much interest in it. I've had a great career writing stories. I love that form so much. This one just, it literally was just, it was a little bit like a, you have a 40-minute lunch planned, and suddenly the talk is so good that you see you're going to be there for 2 hours. It was just like that. And there was no big shift in the mode of writing or any big, trumpet blast saying, you are now a novelist. It was just kind of that the material, it felt like to do the material justice, I had to linger a little bit longer. But throughout, I kept, kind of sending memos to myself like, hey, don't let this bloat up. Do it the same out as fast as you can. In other words, don't take the fact that you're writing a novel as permission to linger and to kind of pad things. I still want it to be really fast and really urgent.
Well, it reads almost more like a screenplay or a script.
Yes. Yeah. Years ago, I'd written, when our kids were little, we were living in a town in upstate New York, and I got really interested in the history of this little town, which is very accessible. They had really great documentation of the people who lived in, those very houses and so on. So at one point when the internet was new, and these chat lines were first making their appearances, I got really interested in the way that text looked on the screen. You'd have someone's name and then a bunch of garbled, misspelled text, and people kind of, I would ask you a question and the answer would only come 2 pages later because of the technology. And that got in my head as an interesting way to tell a story. So many years later, when I was trying to figure out the mechanics of this Lincoln book, that earlier aborted novel came back to me, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. Maybe we can just have the book be a series of monologues, almost disconnected monologues. And that was just exciting to me. And I've learned one thing about writing fiction is the main currency is fun for me. If I think, oh, I'm going to write a history of the Napoleonic Wars and I get really depressed, that's bad. That's not going to turn out well. But if I think of an idea and it makes me kind of like, that could be great, or that'll be a lot of fun to try that, that's the good news for me. So on this one, when I thought of the ghost speaking in that kind of monologue form, I got really excited about it. In other words, I felt I could do it. I felt I could do some, some verve. And then there's always an interesting moment in a project where you go, okay, that nice idea that gets me excited also has some real problems. There are difficulties with that. And one of them is what you described earlier, this monologue presentation is a little disorienting at first for a reader. So I think sometimes when a book comes out and you read people talking about it or criticizing it, the assumption on the part of the critic seems to be that the writer, as they say, approves this message. The writer is 100% sure that this is the best book ever written and totally stands by his methodology. But my experience is it's a lot more complicated than that. It's like, picking an outfit to go out. You have just the right combination, but the pants are too baggy, or they make your butt look big, or the shirt's a little too tight. You walk out the door in a sort of compromised state. You know that the shirt is a little too tight or whatever. Likewise, the book, you choose a certain form, and that form has inherent problems. So artistry has to do somehow with accommodating those problems, not eradicating them, not denying them, but somehow hopefully making them even into an advantage.
Interesting. George,
you're never totally in love with your own book. You're in like with it. You feel like, we've dressed this thing up as best we can. Whatever power there is, we got it through this certain approach, but that approach had a downside too. And so that's, to me, what makes it really wonderful. If it was the case that you could make this perfect thing, walk away dusting off your hands and not worry about it, that doesn't seem that interesting. But to have a kind of flawed but vital thing that you made is a lot more exciting, I think.
Especially when people get it.
Yes, that's right. This book has been really wonderful because there's honestly some people who just can't stand it. They're offended by it, they think it's stupid and all that. Or they make good attempt to read it and it just doesn't gel for them, which leads me to think there might be even different reading modes. There's some people who can read these monologues and sort of fit together into a more conventional narrative. And some people who, for some reason, just don't read that way. It's not a defect. It's just, you know. But there's been another class of people who, you know, will come up to me at readings, and you can see that they really received it. And that's really, really, I think that's kind of, in a way, that's kind of what you're writing for, is the group of people who were sort of constitutionally capable of coming with you on this wild ride and came through it at the end and felt it as much as you did.
Well, it occurs to me that what you're asking the reader to do is almost fill in the blanks.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And at the same time, the making of the blanks allows you to do other things. You know, in other words, one of the things the book, you discover the kind of hidden superpowers of your own book. So in this case, what I discovered was using those monologues, which is admittedly a little off-putting for some people, allows this quality of contradiction in the narrative. So in a traditional novel, you mostly have to, it's not that you have to have one viewpoint, but you're a little locked down in the ultimate narrative viewpoint. You have to sort of, if there's a contradiction, you have to reconcile it. In this book, you could just have people contradicting each other. There's a section where they're talking about Lincoln's eye color, and nobody knows, actually. They keep contradicting each other.
Gray, is it blue? Are they gray? Are they blue? Are they grayish blue? Are they brown?
Right. And that seemed to me a real reward for this methodology, because I think, as I'm getting older, I find that this notion that there is no, I would say there's no objective history after the fact. Now, of course, his eyes were only one color in real life. But as time goes on, and as accounts gather, and accounts are retold and repurposed, and sometimes in other areas they're politicized or they're, you know, recontextualized, you start talking about something that happened 100 years ago. It's very difficult to actually know what happened, and that to me is a scary idea. But it's also kind of a gorgeous idea when you think, you know, even in relation to your own life, you know, you get some high school friends together, you'll find, almost everyone will find, that they're claiming you were at a party you know you didn't go to, you know, or there's some memory of a certain dinner that you can't remember, or you remember differently. To me, that's kind of a beautiful example of what in Buddhist epistemology they call impermanence. This idea that, you know, when we get up in the morning, we sort of resubscribe to a set of beliefs about reality and ourselves that are fairly fixed. You know, as I said earlier, I'm a professor, I'm this, I'm that, and this is the story of my life. You know, on Tuesday, I'm thinking back on my whole 58 years, and this is how I arrived at this moment. Well, in fact, we don't know that. You know, that in fact, we don't really know what our life has been, because our life is certainly more than just our perspective. We've influenced people. We've had effects on the world that we don't even know about, for one thing. Also, when we go to think about our life story, if we had a chance to corroborate it with the people around us, they might feel differently about our role in our life. So that's destabilizing, but I think ultimately it's a, for me, it's an important element of one's spiritual life, which is to say it's humility. You know, we build up our strength and our kind of, I don't know what you'd call it, maybe our arrogance, by having a story and sticking to it. But in reality, you can't have a story and stick to it. You know, we actually can't know the story of our own existence. So, as is the case in the book, I think that argues for a certain kind of humility, a certain kind of emphasis on, you know, presence in the current moment, a certain openness to the experience of others, and so on. So these are all things that, you know, that you write a book like this and these things kind of come to you as secondhand effects, I guess, to be thinking about these things.
George, I understand that actors Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally have purchased the film rights to Lincoln and the Bardo. Given the fantastical nature of the subject matter, are you nervous at all about seeing this on the screen?
Yes. And that's the best thing, is to be a little nervous. Because I was nervous the whole time I wrote this. So I'm always nervous. But I mean, when you have weird material, the first order worry is that you won't be able to pull it off. The second one is that it'll be cheesy, or that the reader won't believe it. You know, so all those things are definitely at play. And I think I'm going to write the screenplay, so that makes me even more nervous. But I think the idea is, in my experience, if you know what you're going to do in a work of art, you're in trouble. Because the danger is you might just do that thing, which somehow ends up to be a bore for everybody. You know, in other words, art is not, in my experience, a process of me knowing what I want to do, and then me doing it, and then dumping it on you, and going, see, wasn't that great? It's much more troubling than that. You know, you start out, the book throws you a curve, this doesn't work, that doesn't work, you're nervous, you're failing. I think the work of art that's vital, it comes from doubt. It comes from problems. It comes from recognizing on page 40 that you've got a huge problem that you didn't anticipate. Then the book kind of grows around that problem and incorporates it and so on. So one of the things I've been saying to the people that, you know, that are involved in the early stages of this movie is, let's remember that it's not going to be the book, and that it's got to be as weird as the book. And we have to go through as strange a process in making a movie as I went through in writing the book. So, and which means sort of saying it might be impossible, you know, and it might be bad.
The characters in The Bardo, with the exception of Willie Lincoln, are fictitious. But the other sections of the book are, I guess you could almost call them kind of cut and paste history sources.
That's right. Yeah. There was a point where the ghosts were kind of dominating the book. And I noticed two things. One is that was starting to test my imaginary reader's credulity a little bit. You know, there's the sense of a ghost is sort of a fun thing for the writer to do that might be a little bit too whimsical. And then second of all, I noticed that the things that had attracted me to the story emotionally early on were kind of missing from the book. So the history, the story of Willie's illness and so on was gone. And so I struggled a lot. You know, I wrote some sort of traditional third-person accounts, and it seemed kind of a little bit lacking in pep. So at one point in desperation, I just turned to myself and said, well, how do you know about those events? And I just answered, well, I read them in these history books. And that person said, well, just put them in like that. And, you know, then I thought, well, can you do that? And then I thought, well, my book, I can do what I like. So I did just as you described. I typed up, you know, all the relevant sections from about five different books that I've been reading for 10 or 15 years, and then got down on the floor with some scissors and just cut them up into different arrangements. And, you know, at some point in that, I felt a little nuts, like, this is not writing. But then, you know, after 3 or 4 days of it, patterns start to emerge and dramatic motion starts to emerge, and you think, well, it's maybe not writing, but it's curating of a certain type, and if it serves the emotional needs of the book, then de facto it is writing. So I kind of got into it, and in fact, that was for me when I kind of knew I'd be able to make a book of this, was when I got the first the party scene written in this form, this curated form. I thought, yeah, this has got a little bit of power, and it's very sad, you know. And then at some point I had all these sections that were 100% from history books, and the fiction writer in me just started feeling things I wanted to add, you know, little details or little motions or little summaries I wanted to add. And so I thought, well, you know, am I allowed to fictionalize these ostensibly historical accounts, make up new ones? And again, I thought, well, it's your book, and it's a novel. It's not a history book. It's a novel, and your primary responsibility is to drama. And to emotional power. So then I started selectively making up historical accounts and dropping in. And so by the end, it was kind of this strange soup of a lot of different forms of monologue that I considered myself 100% responsible for all of them, you know.
So for the casual reader, there's no way other than perhaps Googling all those sources to know which ones are real and which ones are not?
Exactly. And in fact, early on, the ones that I made up were a little bit showboaty, you know, so I had to kind of tone them down to mix, you know, so they would blend. We had talked about putting a bibliography in for the paperback, and I thought, well, why would we do that? You know, this is part of the fun of this is that it's me telling you a story, you know. So I think we, you know, the reader has to sort of buy into that contract. It reminds me a little bit like when you go, you know, when somebody's telling a scary story and they say, you know, this is a ghost story and it happened in this very room. And you're like, no, it didn't. You're just making it up. But if you consent to that, you have a more powerful experience. So in the end, yeah, I just, you know, intend to keep it pretty hazy. And in fact, it's funny, I don't remember myself now which are real and which aren't. I have to go to my bibliography to, you know, to see if it was a real source or an invented one. But I did have certain rules. You know, the thing was I didn't want to use that privilege of inventing those things to radically change the story. So usually what I was doing was just trying to accentuate what was already there, which to me actually felt more truthful. You know, when you live with these anecdotes and you're reading so many hundreds of history books, you develop a kind of sixth sense about the truth behind all these accounts. In a sense, I guess what I'd say is you start to novelize the incident in your mind. You know, so this party scene that I described, I have a really rich, almost like a sense memory of that party that didn't come from any one book. It was my mind sort of completing the story. So then you think, well, that's the one I want you to have. I want you to have that complete three-dimensional version that I have in my mind. If I have to supplement the dry historical text to do that, I consider that my right and my privilege as a fiction writer.
It also makes for, I think probably for a better flow, because stylistically, it reads much like the sections with the ghost, that you're getting sources from, you're getting the story from many different sources, and it's in kind of a choppy form.
Right, exactly. And so that was one of the problems with when I was writing the history in a more fluid third person account. It took you out of that mode of reading. So that's exactly right. And then I think, you know, ultimately what it reminded me or taught me is that in fiction, you're really, both reader and writer are signed up for this idea that by making up a story and putting everything you have into it with the intention of being entertaining, you can, the two of you, the reader and the writer, can actually get to a higher level truth than you can get to with just strict objective fact. That's why we have always told stories. There's a magical quality and a terrifying quality of life that somehow doesn't get done justice in the quotidian frame. So every so often we put on our party hats and we tell or we receive a story. We go into that sort of exalted state. And I don't know really why we do that. I think it's just, I think it's to remind us of death, you know, to remind us that our habitual way of thinking is actually inadequate to the situation we're in down here on Earth. Now, we have to have that habitual way of thinking to go to the bank and pick up the kids and do all that stuff. But when you actually think that we're only here for a short time, contrary to how it feels, we're not permanent, we're not forever, I think every so often we have to ritually go into this higher air just to keep our sanity and to remind ourselves that, you know, the things that we can easily understand through our senses are only first level things, and there's a whole bunch of stuff that we'll never understand, but that we can sometimes just like poke our head into a little bit. I think art is one of the most profound ways to do that.
George, do you have a copy of the book with you? If you don't mind, I'd love to have you read an excerpt.
I do, yeah. Let me just see. Yeah, so this is just a section where the dead kind of reflect on what it feels like to be in that state of being dead and a little bit forgotten, and their vague sense that they're being underestimated by the living. Please do not misunderstand. We had been mothers, fathers, had been husbands in many years, men of import who had come here that first day accompanied by crowds so vast and sorrowful that, surging forward to hear the oration, they had damaged fences beyond repair, had been young wives diverted here during childbirth, our gentle qualities stripped from us by the naked pain of that circumstance, who left behind husbands so enamored of us, so tormented by the horrors of those last moments, the notion that we had gone down that awful black hole, pain sundered from ourselves, that they had never loved again, had been bulky men, quietly content, who in our first youth had come to grasp our own unremarkableness and had cheerfully, as if amusedly accepting a heavy burden, shifted our life's focus. If we would not be great, we would be useful, would be rich and kind, and thereby able to effect good, smiling, hands in pockets, watching the world we had subtly improved, walking past this empty dowry filled, that education secretly funded, had been affable, joking servants of whom our masters had grown fond for the cheering words we managed as they launched forth on days full of import, had been grandmothers, tolerant and frank, recipients of certain dark secrets who, by the quality of their unjudging listening, granted tacit forgiveness and thus let in the sun. What I mean to say is we had been considerable, had been loved, not lonely, not lost, not freakish, but wise, each in his or her own way. Our departures caused pain. Those who had loved us sat upon their beds, heads in hand, lowered their faces to tabletops, making animal noises. We had been loved, I say, and remembering us, even many years later, people would smile, briefly gladdened at the memory.